For many of us of any political persuasion, the steady stream of economic optimism seen on corporate news seems far removed from the daily struggles of friends and family who have lost their jobs or faced bankruptcy.
Percentage increase, how does that necessarily relate to the overall corporate spending environment? Are you a direct beneficiary?
I think we'll see a nice jump in the stock price.
I'm Liz Chambers. Today, we offer a reality check on the U.S. economy. You'll learn how 10 years of short-sighted trade policy has brought us to the threshold of financial ruin. What began with Bill Clinton's blind embrace of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, has led us to new White House policies that have exploded the federal deficit, encouraged growing personal debt, and left billions of American dollars in foreign hands. Later, we'll offer specific solutions, both political and personal, that could avert economic disaster. We begin, however, with the recent controversy over the sale of 22 U.S. ports to the tiny, super-rich nation of Dubai. That's right, there were 22 ports for sale, not six, as was widely reported.
With 5.7 to 5.9 million containers coming in every year to our seaports, we've decided it's okay for a Middle Eastern country, United Arab Emirates, with its history, to manage our seaports through a wholly owned company.
The story that every major news outlet missed is that America's ports are just the latest key piece of U.S. infrastructure to hit the auction block. Thanks to so-called free trade, unregulated foreign corporations are buying up everything from our water supplies to our military plants. In Maine, for example, the British-owned Nestle Company, which was listed as one of the 14 worst corporations in 2005 by a global exchange report, is draining state aquifers and selling this finite resource all over the world. Just how deep and wide does the sellout go? These U.S. government statistics show what percentage of American firms are owned by other countries. For example, almost two-thirds of our movie industry is owned by foreigners. The list goes on and on. Half of our plastics industry owes allegiance to foreign masters. More than a third of our industrial machinery plants are owned by outsiders. Almost all of the consumer goods we use so wastefully are made in Asia. Yet Americans continue to consume as if the party will never end.
Who do you think made them? What's the answer?
Keeping the U.S. party supplied with cheap goods, however, often means exploiting unregulated labor overseas. Wall Street tells us that globalism raises the bar for everyone, but in reality, most money flows to the owners and managers of corporations.
Because we still believe that it is more easier for us to control the lady workers instead of the main workers.
More after this.
Disney is a transnational media conglomerate, owning TV and radio networks, cable systems, internet sites, music studios, media production companies, magazines, sports teams, theaters, and theme parks.
Almost everybody who interviewed me would often begin by saying, "Aren't you afraid of writing about Disney critically?" And I was stunned. And I thought, where am I living? Am I living in a police state?
It's amazing when you look at Disney and Disney movies over the years, is how little the image of females has really changed. You still have the same highly sexualized female body with the big breasts, the tiny waists, the fluttering eyelashes, the coy expressions, the seductress.
Doesn't eat at all.
And yet the whole thrust of the story is that she returns to him, that she socializes him, that she excuses him, that she reinterprets his rage and his abuse as temper. And this is a movie that is saying to our children, overlook the abuse, overlook the violence. There's a tender prince lurking within, and it's your job to kiss that prince and bring it out, or to kiss that beast and bring the prince out. That's a dangerous message.
Kids in Africa see it. They see a white man in Africa who's superior, swinging from trees, and they see no Africans. And they see gorillas being the ones they relate to. Is it promoting white supremacy?
I never seen any black people in Disney's movie.
I can't think of any Disney movies that have black people.
We have no obligation to make history. We have no obligation to make art. We have no obligation to make a statement. To make money is our only objective.
Foreign firms now own huge swaths of America's raw materials. For example, half of our coal mines are foreign-owned. Why does this matter? Take coal as one example. While there is no such thing as clean coal processing at present, Vice President Dick Cheney often promises that if such technology ever does exist, coal will deliver our future energy.
And for long-term energy security, we will encourage breakthrough technologies from zero-emission coal burning to hydrogen fuel to cutting-edge methods of producing ethanol.
Given the level of foreign ownership, however, we might now find ourselves buying back our own coal from foreigners. Even our military factories are now on the auction block. The United Kingdom is buying the American company that makes Bradley tanks. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is greenlighting India's offer to build F-16 fighter jets. Will the day come when a foreign nation attacks us using our best technology?
Lockheed Martin. Global partnerships. Global presence. Global knowledge. Integrating 21st century global combat support solutions and providing harmonization for worldwide customer savings and support.
How did we get here, to the point where U.S. capitalism is devouring itself? It wasn't by accident. As economist Clyde Prestowitz points out, our trade policies have created a new world of 3 billion capitalists. Sometime in the 1980s, under President Reagan's fast-track initiatives, U.S. economic policy began to shift away from the traditional model of high tariffs on imported goods. Free traders called that system isolationist and declared that unrestricted global trade would raise all economic boats at once. All of the rest of the world, however, continued to impose tariffs to maintain their market advantage. Since President Clinton signed NAFTA into law in 1994, America has lost 10 million manufacturing jobs. The federal government is $800 billion in debt. Consumers are spending 121% of what they make, saving nothing for the uncertain future. The Bush administration bought its way out of recession by borrowing money and driving the deficit to an unsustainable level. In a new book, Bruce Bartlett, an economic advisor to both President Reagan and George Bush the elder, says the policies of George Bush the younger and Dick Cheney have made the weaknesses of GATT, NAFTA, and the World Trade Organization far worse. CBS interviewed Bartlett, but the reporters seemed more focused on discrediting him as a source than listening to his grave concerns about the U.S. economy.
When you wrote this book, you were working with a conservative think tank, and what happened?
Well, they weren't too terribly pleased when they read the manuscript, and they fired me 3 weeks later.
You got fired, and will anybody else touch you at this point?
No, offers are available. I'm available for offers, but none of them forthcoming.
Not a lot forthcoming. On the first page, you come right out of the box, and you call the president an imposter. You say he's a pretend conservative. Why?
Well, I just don't think that he has the same attitudes that, say, Ronald Reagan had, most especially vastly expanding the size of government. Spending has just gone through the roof. He refuses to veto anything. We've had a protectionist trade policy, massive new government regulations on business from the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation.
Economists such as Bartlett and Prestowitz point out a handful of key weaknesses in the U.S. economy. For example, here are three of their biggest concerns. Because of the huge federal deficit, foreign banks now hold billions of dollars of our treasury. Any further sign of weakness in the U.S. economy could trigger the massive dumping of U.S. dollars. The result, Prestowitz says, could be an immediate cascade effect, a world financial panic on a scale that would dwarf the Great Depression of the 1930s.
Bedlam reigned at the New York Stock Exchange as frantic traders dealt with more than half a billion sell orders flooding Wall Street. The drop marked a 22% decline, nearly twice that of the drop that sparked the Great Depression. It took just half a day of furious activity to surpass Friday's record volume, which topped 338 million shares.
In the past 5 years, we lost 2.9 million manufacturing jobs, about 17% of the workforce. But without domestic manufacturing, new U.S. inventions have to be manufactured overseas. As a result, we quickly lose any intellectual competitive edge. We hear a lot about U.S. manufacturing jobs being replaced by knowledge jobs, but most of the best-paid new jobs are being outsourced to India, where highly skilled, educated people earn a fraction of what the same worker does here. Writer Paul Craig Roberts notes that we often hear about a shortage of engineers in the U.S. He calls that talk absolute ignorance. Here's the real story, Roberts says. Key industries, information, telecommunication, bookkeeping, and even computer systems have all lost jobs recently. America is awash in unemployment among the highly educated. In other words, when politicians talk about new service jobs to replace manufacturing, they're really referring to poverty wage jobs offered by multinational corporations such as Walmart.
Retail giant Walmart is encouraging its workers to go on welfare.
Instead of paying for its employees to have health benefits, she says Walmart is making the government take care of it.
In Florida, Walmart has more employees and family members eligible for Medicaid than any other company. Critics accuse the retail giant of using Medicaid and state programs for the poor as its health care plan.
This report from UC Berkeley researchers concludes Walmart costs state taxpayers $86 million a year and county taxpayers as much as another $25 million to pick up the tab for public health care, income tax credits, housing subsidies, and food stamps.
We'll be right back.
It had taken Enron 16 years to go from about $10 billion of assets to $65 billion of assets, and took them 24 days to go bankrupt.
The fatal flaw at Enron was pride, arrogance, intolerance.
All that money you guys stole from those poor grandmothers.
Did you convert stock worth $66 million?
I don't know.
I netted approximately $100 million.
Enron is a company that deals with everyone with absolute integrity.
To argue about my compensation, and if I step on somebody's throat on the way, that doubles it. Well, I'll stomp on the guy's throat.
The other thing about people at Enron is a lot of them were former nerds. You wanted to be the most popular guy on Wall Street, and you were going to do whatever you had to do.
They sought out every loophole they could in order to profit.
The rules weren't quite clear.
They could bury debt, they could bury losses.
An industry that was very reliable for 100 years was all of a sudden turned into a casino.
Those guys could just yank the California economy on its leash whenever they wanted to, and they did it, and they did it, and they did it.
He just steals money from California to the tune of $1 million or two a day.
Can we rephrase that?
Could I predict phony energy crisis as a result of deregulation? Yes. Could I predict that Arnold Schwarzenegger would be our governor as a result of deregulation?
Oh, I didn't expect that.
How exactly does Enron make its money?
Accounting doesn't get that creative.
I would like to know if you are on crack.
This is the shredded evidence that came out of Enron.
Everyone was on the bandwagon, and it can happen again.
We are the good guys. We are on the side of angels.
It has evolved to the corporate crime of the century.
Economist Thomas I. Pally notes that in the last recession, the U.S. economy bounced back using Treasury tools that are no longer available. Most notably, the Bush administration lowered interest rates and racked up more than $600 billion worth of government spending to jumpstart the recovery. But federal coffers are now barer than ever. There's no safety net.
Bankruptcy. Is it an out for many of you? In most cases, not anymore. If you make more than the median wage in the state that you live, bankruptcy is not an option. So it is very, very important that every single one of you understand, can you afford the debt you're taking on? What will it cost you? Because guess what? You may be stuck with it forever.
Can we pull out of this economic tailspin? It's possible, but it will require a nearly complete about-face on the part of the current administration and the Republican-controlled Congress. Here's a checklist of measures Prestowitz says should be undertaken immediately. A tax on consumer goods will slow consumption and encourage a return to the normal 8-10% personal savings rate. By cutting unnecessary military programs, the U.S. could redirect tens of billions towards keeping competitive. Progressive Democrats recently introduced just such a plan titled the Common Sense Budget Act, redirecting $60 billion in defense spending to schools, health care, worker training, and deficit reduction. Only a national standardized plan can hope to rein in out-of-control drug and medical costs, at the same time preserving health care quality. Money now spent on corporate welfare and the military will be shifted to salaries for teachers and higher education so that Americans can remain highly competitive in the world marketplace. Of course, given the power that corporations exert over politicians of both parties, such proposals seem far-fetched. Today's economists, with a few rare exceptions, see progress in terms of eternal growth, never sustainability. Under the current model, every time someone gets a divorce, the gross domestic product goes up as lawyers' fees are paid and families divide into separate households. The inevitable result of the endless growth imperative is self-destruction as we lay waste to our environment and battle over dwindling resources. At the same time, another powerful view of our economic future is emerging, one that speaks to the heart and challenges the very foundations of our current economic structure. It's a system that could prove relatively stable during a wide-scale economic crisis.
Most of us have heard of babysitting pools, where you put in an hour and babysitting for somebody else in the pool, and then when you need an hour, you can get it from somebody else. And time banking, in many ways, works that way. It works as neighbors helping neighbors, and it's not just babysitting. It can be screwing light bulbs in the ceiling for an elderly person who doesn't want to get up on a ladder. It can be hanging curtains. It can be mowing the lawn. It can be leaf raking. It can be giving a ride to somebody who's lost night vision or doesn't have a car. So it's a whole array of very basic things that people do and don't even know they can do it. Then some economists measured two things. They measured the value of household work, and in 1998, the measurement was taken by an outfit called Redefining Progress, and they figured out it was $1.9 trillion, which was roughly one quarter of the whole GDP, and that's, of course, not measured, not included in GDP.
Writers such as Tom Hartman, Jerry Mander, and Charlene Spretnak describe an alternative future of community-based economies, a reconnection of humans with their communities and geographic regions. It's a movement that puts economic control back into the hands of people, small farmers, local retailers, and local lenders. It also cuts out the middleman, the federal government.
On the radar screen. It was not measured by any of the standard measures that measure the GDP in progress and growth. And as I began looking at what the elements of that economy were, I thought, well, it's family and household, it's neighborhood, it's community, and it's civil society. And then somebody asked me, well, if it's an economy, what does it produce? And I said, well, I thought about it, nothing of significance, just healthy children, strong families, care for the elderly, safe neighborhoods, democracy, environmental protection and social justice, and democracy. Other than that, nothing important, nothing that anybody would want to count.
Many other nations around the world, angry with the arrogance of the United States in recent years, may be glad to see the current system come tumbling down, but the pain will be felt worldwide. Ultimately, local, self-reliant economies may be best equipped to weather the coming storm. If the modern economic model of endless consumption and destruction does fail as predicted, the words of Charlene Spretnak, a champion of local economies of scale, may linger with us.
To all the country people whose love for the earth and its cycles made them objects of contempt in the modern urban mind. To all the parents who pleaded with officials of the industrialized nation-state to recognize the connection between radiation or toxic dumping and their malnourished or sickly children. To all those who fought to save their communities and their livelihoods from the callous control of giant corporations and cartels. To all those children who tried valiantly to hold on to their early sense of the world as wondrously creative and vibrantly alive, even as they were jammed into the grid of modern schooling. We here declare that you were right. You were right, and your suffering was not in vain. Your tears have fertilized the earth, from which now grow more resistance efforts than can be counted, more resilience than can be known.
That's all for today. Kevin Quinn is coming up to talk about some other books you should read while you still can.
Have you ever had a dangerous idea? Something that you were afraid to write down? What if your idea fell into the wrong hands? You might throw the world into chaos. Women might demand the right to vote. Blacks might refuse to ride on the back of the bus. The elderly might get a share of your tax dollars instead of dying of starvation in their beds. Apparently, some people wish that ideas like these had never seen the light of day. A conservative group recently selected the most harmful books of the last two centuries. They also included a bunch of honorable mentions. Who's on the list? Social reformers, economic reformers, educational reformers. Are we sensing a theme here? We asked Paul Friedland, a professor of history at Bowdoin College, to take a look at their hit list. His first observation: many of these books are the same ones that were burned by the Nazis in 1939, with the notable exception of Mein Kampf. Apparently, these conservatives share Hitler's dislike of Freud, Engels, Marx, and Comte. Like the Nazis, they also ignore ideas in these books that sound like their own rhetoric. For example, U.S. conservatives despise the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx. Better dead than read, right? Well, Hitler's propaganda chief, Joseph Goebbels, coined that phrase. Ironically, Marx wrote that the biggest victims of free trade would be the traditional family. Isn't that conservative territory? Permit me. Veiled by religious and political illusions, the bourgeoisie, translation, rich capitalists, have resolved personal worth into exchange value. They have reduced the family relation into a mere money relation. James Dobson, eat your heart out.
That will destroy the family, which will destroy the nation, and I think eventually have a major impact on Western civilization.
The Nazis destroyed any book that they saw as un-German for fear that people might challenge their propaganda. That's how it usually goes. People in power try to silence ideas that contradict their own. Imagine if today's narrow-minded censors had things their way. Without Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, thousands of American children might still be suffering horrible birth defects from the use of DDT. Wish away Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed, and 10,000 lives might be lost every year for want of auto seatbelts. In 1966, Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart wrote that censorship reflects a society's lack of confidence in itself. It is a hallmark of an authoritarian regime. You might think that book burning is a barbaric relic of the past, but in recent years, far-right Christian groups have cooked up everything from Harry Potter books to Disney movies. In 2001, a small Pennsylvania church held a demon roast, where members could deposit offensive media of any sort into a burn box. As the box went up in flames, the members began to sing. Their demon box contained several videos, including Disney's Pinocchio and Aladdin, along with The Lost World and Ace Ventura. Is Jim Carrey Satan, perhaps? To get the fire hot enough to melt all that plastic, they threw in some short stories by Ernest Hemingway and a copy of The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. Of course, nowadays, you don't need a bonfire to destroy new ideas. Today's media gatekeepers can kill a thought long before it goes public. For example, when was the last time you saw a television program advocating a vegetarian lifestyle? What about a made-for-TV movie that advocates living in a smaller house or driving a smaller car to save energy? Imagine a program arguing that we must have fewer children. Yeah, right. What about a news broadcast suggesting that a good liberal arts education is as important to America's future as math and science? No way. Instead, what you get is government propaganda that says we need to turn the colleges into vocational schools.
possible. But I will tell you, since I manage a lot of people, that problem solving and creativity, the ability to work in a group, those are skills that are needed in any field. And mathematics and science, especially math, teach those sort of problem-solving skills. And so whether you're going to be a historian or a mom or a college professor, you have to be able to solve problems. And that's what we're taught in math and science. I know I hate to tell you all this, but that's the way of the world.
Blacklisting books is the first step towards suppression of the human spirit. Writers who challenge the status quo almost always have something to add to human progress. In Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, for example, book burning has become a national pastime, but the human thirst for knowledge will not be suppressed. In the end, a handful of people take it upon themselves to become human books, memorizing important literature to be saved for a later time, when man's ignorance and fear have been overcome.
Now here's Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. And here's The Corsair by Byron. She used to be married to a chief of police. Now, that skinny fellow is Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll. Where's Alice through the looking glass today? She should be somewhere about. Ah, now there's The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. He ate his book so they couldn't burn it.
Let's keep these cultural fearmongers nervously rubbing their palms together, shall we? Go out today and read a controversial book. Make your own judgment. Together, we can keep the door of free thinking open. No matter how badly the censors of the right want to shrink the universe of ideas to a size they can drown in a bathtub. Thanks for watching. If you'd like more people in your area to see our show, why not sponsor us on Public Access TV? Contact us by email and we'll walk you through the process. I'm Kevin Quinn, and we'll see you next month. Liberty News TV depends on the generous support of our viewers. For more information, visit our website.
The evil doers.
And I speak my mind about this administration.